Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
There is certainly a potential for a very large and substantial oxygen problem because of this biological oxygen demand in the water. And that demand, as I said, is driven largely by methane gas. And the gas, it expands as you reduce the pressure.
We're going on 3 months since the start of the worst oil disaster in U.S. history. And according to our guest, Dr. Samantha Joy of the University of Georgia Marine Science Department, it's more accurate to call this a hydrocarbon spill, given the high concentrations of methane and other gases that have leaked from the wellhead and from seeps near it. Dr. Joy has been conducting research into the impacts of the spill, testing water, with a team funded by NOAA. Prior to the latest attempt at capping the well, she explained what some of the risks would look like. With bad weather, a tropical depression storm approaching the Gulf of Mexico, the government and BP Joint Task Force called a press conference, and Thad Allen, the National Incident Commander, took our questions. We asked him first what percentage of oil versus methane and other gas may be leaking from the wellhead, the cap, or other leaks identified after the most recent test capping of the blown well.
We believe, especially around the current blowout preventer and the capping stack, that it is a mixture of the hydrocarbon column itself, which would be some mixture of oil, some natural gas, and some water. The existence of hydrates on the blowout preventer and the capping stack is indicia that there is gas there, because the gas combined with the cold water and the pressure is what produces hydrates. So there is some amount of methane gas in that. The exact percentages, we have taken samples, and they're being analyzed ashore. Some samples done on scene based on the samples we're taking in around the wellhead indicated there was about 16% methane, but that needs to be validated by a shore test.
During the July 21st press conference, we also asked Thad Allen to describe all of the leaks identified since the capping test and to talk about any new ones they've just discovered.
And I can take you through the general grouping of them. On the 17th of July, that was the event that we noted that was 3 kilometers southwest of the wellhead that we now have attributed to be in place before this started, probably attributable to another well. Then we had a series of anomalies that were detected on the 18th of July, and these are just differences in density and return on both the seismic and the acoustic sensors. They were investigated with ROVs. They thought there might be some plumes or some gas bubbles, but when they were followed up with ROVs, there were no other indications observed, and we closed out on those. Following that, on the 19th is when we started to observe the bubbles around the current wellhead and the blowout preventer. Those have already been reported, and these are emanating from the wellhead itself through gaskets and seals that happen to be leaking. And finally, we found another leak just yesterday in the BOP on the annular preventer. That's the upper part of the BOP or the lower marine riser package, and that's attributed to a leak in a gasket as well. I think what you're generally starting to see is from the blowout preventer, it's been down there a long time under a lot of stress, and just like any other piece of equipment, we're starting to see some small leaks around it. But that's been it so far.
Dr. Samantha Joy of the University of Georgia became prominent in the headlines after establishing new problems in the Gulf of Mexico due to large plumes of oil and methane, posing a risk to oxygen levels in the water column. BP downplayed the results of her initial tests. Dr. Joy has persisted, though, in her research, and she points out that the type of specific testing she's been doing takes time and multiple analyses. She documents her research at gulfblog.uga.edu, and a documentary produced by the University of Georgia is airing this week through the Georgia Public Broadcast Network. On July 9th, we asked Dr. Samantha Joy to discuss unique problems related to the specific drill site of the Deepwater Horizon. The rig that would have produced a very large amount had it been operational now appears to be sitting on a large methane gas field, which poses further risk. Pressure from the capped well could put too much force on weak points, a known fissure identified along the pipeline, for example, and other locations at or near the BP rig.
The Macondo prospect, which is what the Deepwater Horizon was drilling into, it's an interesting and unique reservoir because many of the oil reservoirs in the Gulf of Mexico are overlain by salt. This one is overlain by sandstone. And the difference between salt and sandstone is a really, really important one. Salt has, it's a very tight crystal structure, very low permeability, very low porosity. You're not going to get gas accumulating in salt, okay? It's easy to drill through. It makes a nice, tight cap rock. It's an ideal cap for for an oil reservoir, if you want, if your goal is to tap into the reservoir and get the oil and gas out of it, then you want salt over the reservoir. Macondo has sandstone above it. And sandstone, which, you know, most people can relate to, is just sand. It's very porous, high permeability, and can contain enormous amounts of gas. And this reservoir, the overlying sandstone, is very, very, very gassy. And that's why when you hear these stories about when they were drilling this reservoir, they kept getting kicks of gas, gas burping up the pipe and causing kicks and problems with drilling. That's because the sandstone they were drilling through was very, very gassy. It's sort of like the situation in the North Sea where you're dealing through very, very gassy sands to get to the oil underneath it. So that made drilling into the reservoir difficult and dangerous. And when the drilling mud was removed from the pipe and replaced with seawater, the pressure, they had no way to regulate the pressure in the hole, and, you know, gas came up the pipe and exploded, and the rest is history. But it's the gas that caused all the problems during drilling. It's the gas that led to the fire and explosion that led to the sinking of the Deepwater Horizon and really generated the entire accident and the mismanagement of how to handle the gas during the drilling. I mean, I'm not an engineer, and I use the word mismanagement probably a little loosely, but the fact that they, knowing that this was a gassy hole and replacing the drilling mud with seawater sort of opened the door that, knowing how gassy this well was, I think that was why there was debate about, you know, removing the drilling mud from the hole. So when that bolus of gas came up the pipe, then you've got a big problem because now you have no control over pressure and you can't regulate it. And as I said, that's what ultimately led to the explosion and sinking of the rig. Gas is why the top hat didn't work, right? Most of the problems they've had trying to control this well have been related to the gas flow and the formation of hydrates. And the gas is really the sort of the evil demon of this story because the gas isn't manageable. It expands tremendously with reductions in pressure. You know, when you have the pressure of the reservoir and you take that reservoir fluid and you then take it up to the surface of the seafloor or the surface of the ocean, you've got hundreds-fold increase in volume of gas, about 600 times to be exact. So a meter cubed of gas at the reservoir temperature and pressure is about 600 meters cubed out of the reservoir. And that's a tremendous, tremendous problem. And the gas represents a serious issue for the water column for the ocean because of the oxygen demand that it represents. So the gas is the problem. In terms of the fissure, I've heard many, many stories about fissures, and I don't know exactly what is meant by that, whether it's a fissure along the seafloor or, you know, the casing isn't intact and has a fissure in it and gas is coming into the casing below the seafloor or something like that. I mean, there are many, many possibilities, and I haven't seen evidence to convince me that any of them is real or accurate. But I don't doubt for a minute that the gassy nature of this reservoir could result in some of the gas coming out of the pipe at the seafloor could be leaking into the pipe through a fissure in the casing because there's, what, 12,000 feet of pipe or thereabouts between the seafloor and the reservoir. And when this thing originally exploded, if there was any damage to that subseafloor casing, then gas from the sandstone could leak into the casing and out the top of the hole. And that makes it even more difficult to cap it and control it because, again, the gas, it expands as you reduce the pressure. So, you know, you're not dealing with a constant here. And the oil is going to change, too, in terms of volume, but it's the opposite problem. The gas is expanding. The oil, when it gets colder, is going to contract a little. So the gas is, I think, really what makes this engineering-wise a nightmare to deal with.
Are you suggesting, too, that capping this thing may cause pressure that would make underlying line problems worse and perhaps even worse than what they're dealing with now?
It certainly is not unreasonable to think that and wonder about it. I think that without having relief wells in place, given the fact there is so much pressure, that the reservoir is so overpressured with gas, and we don't know what state the subsea floor casing is in, doing what they're doing now, which is siphoning off as much as they can, to me, that's probably the best thing they can be doing until they get the relief wells in place. I would worry a great deal about capping it off completely because of overpressure. And you don't even have to worry about deep subsea floor casing. You know, just the stress on the casing near the seafloor from the failure of the rig and the collapse of the riser, you could have a fracture in the casing. There are at least three ruptures in the pipe, I've heard. So, you know, at the seafloor. And if there's something that's shallow below the seafloor that you can't really see, I mean, there's just no telling how much damage there is to the casing. And I'm just talking shallow, not deep. So it's just impossible to say without seeing all of the data. I'm sure they've done scans of the pipe, and they know where the weak points are, if there are any, at least the shallow ones. And I think that what they're doing now is probably the best thing that they can do, given the circumstances, until those relief wells are in.
If the relief wells don't work, their backup plan is to route the oil some miles away to other wells. What about that? It seems as if more technology would be used and more of an opportunity for failures of the kind that would be impossible to deal with.
It seems to me that we've let a genie out of the bottle here. And, you know, getting her back in the bottle is going to be difficult. And, you know, you're right. It could make things worse. It could create unexpected difficulties. But we simply don't know at this point how the system's going to respond and how even tenable, you know, the option of using far-field wells to pump this reservoir. I think that's sort of something that's being put out there as, if this doesn't work, then we have a backup plan. It may work out that, you know, this thing simply has to flow until the pressure is relieved to such an extent that they can safely cap it. They've got a lot more information about the reservoir and its behavior than any of us on the outside do. And I have to believe that they're really trying to do everything in their power to they're doing everything in their power to control this thing. But at the same time, they don't want to make it worse. And I think that they're being conservative, and justly so, because you don't want to make this worse. And believe you me, they could make it worse by capping it and overpressuring it and having it blow out somewhere else that you can't control at all. Like if there was a rupture in the casing far down in the seafloor, then you can't really fix that. So they want to keep it at a problem that is to some extent controllable.
We heard concerns expressed by Dr. Craig McLean of McLean Labs that there is the possibility that in the Gulf of Mexico, there will be a tipping point reached. Can you comment on what that might mean?
There are chances that this could alter flow in the system with respect to how things flow from top to bottom and bottom to top. And the oxygen issue is a big one, because if you deplete oxygen from surface water, you can replace it pretty easily with atmospheric exchange or with primary production by phytoplankton. That's why anoxic hypoxic zones in, like, the Mississippi River Plume anoxic zone, that's a seasonal feature. It happens in the summer when the water is stratified and stable, and then when it mixes up in the winter, it resets itself and goes away. Well, in the deep water, there is no such seasonal reset button that you can push to set the system back up as it was before. If oxygen gets depleted in the deep water, then that's going to take decades for it to get replenished. The rates of processes that we're seeing in the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico are like you would measure in a nasty eutrophied estuary, you know, with just tons of nasty organic carbon being pumped into it. And that's exactly what's happening from this oil spill. You've got a lot of labile material being put into the system at the bottom, so you're short-circuiting the whole thing. So there is a chance that this could really alter how the entire system functions. The Gulf of Mexico is not going to go anoxic by any stretch of the imagination, but having lenses of anoxic water deep below the surface can alter how the surface and bottom water are connected within those areas.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. Our interview July 9th with Dr. Samantha Joy. She and a team at the University of Georgia Department of Marine Science are conducting experiments on methane regulation.
To my knowledge, we're the only ones doing those sorts of experiments. Like, what regulates the ability of the microbial community to consume methane and keep it out of the atmosphere?
Dr. Joy's work is often done by exploring the ocean's depths in the Gulf of Mexico. Her blog is gulfblog.uga.edu. British Petroleum did cap their blown well experimentally before completion of the relief wells.
The relief well bore has been drilled, but the last final section that we want to reinforce with pipe needs to be done before we can begin the actual interception of the well. That's called running a casing line, or basically a hollow steel pipe that reinforces the well bore.
As a storm bears down on the Gulf of Mexico, Incident Commander Thad Allen said they may call for a total evacuation of the drill site if weather becomes untenable. That would mean a loss of visual capability, delaying a planned static kill of the wellhead with mud and cement. It had been tentatively scheduled for this weekend. It could also mean reopening the wellhead to relieve pressure. Dr. Joy's studies predicted some of what she did see in the Gulf of Mexico after the BP spill.
We anticipated that there would be deep-sea features, plumes in the water, sedimenting oil on the bottom, because of previous work that had been done with models of deep-water blowouts. So when this oil spill first happened, we decided to try and get out there as soon as possible and look for features like the ones that had been predicted by the models. Unfortunately, we found those features, and the first indication that there were these deep-water features were optical signatures related to colored dissolved organic matter. So oil and other types of organic matter fluoresce light at certain wavelengths. So you can use specialized sensors that are tuned to certain wavelengths. You drop them down through the water column and you can identify areas in the water where you have elevated signatures of compounds that are oil-like. So the Pelican cruise was funded by a NOAA program, and they were out about 2 weeks after the spill started, and you know that cruise went for a couple of weeks. They collected samples from the plumes and the water above and below the plumes. It was more of a search and document cruise, and it was followed by a cruise that I did that was more chemistry and microbiology focused on the R.V. Walton Smith. And on that cruise, we went out and tried to track the plumes as close as we could to the wellhead, and we got within about a half a mile, three-quarters of a mile away. And what we found was that not only was there oil in the water, but there was a lot of dissolved gas in the water as well, methane and other thermogenic hydrocarbons, which are derived from the leaking wellhead.
Now, why do they call them thermogenic?
They're called thermogenic because there's two ways to make gas. One is biology. So microorganisms can make methane out of organic matter. Like we eat Wheaties in the morning and, you know, we respire CO2. They eat organic matter and turn it into methane. That's sort of their exhalant product. So we exhale CO2, they exhale methane. Thermogenic methane is produced when you take organic matter and you bury it for long periods of time way below the seafloor, and it gets heated up and cooked. It's just like cooking something in the oven, except you cook it at much higher temperatures for much longer periods of time. And these thermogenic gases tend to be methane plus a mixture of other gases, ethane, propane, butane, pentane, for example. So biogenic gas is predominantly methane. It's almost entirely methane, whereas thermogenic gas has methane plus a lot of other low molecular weight gases. And it's just produced abiotically through long-term, you know, geological cooking of organic matter.
Dr. Joy, about the oxygen, I know that initially you had grave concerns and then the testing surprised you. We phoned British Petroleum and their spokesperson assured us that their findings, or yours, I'm not sure whose they were talking about, and they were not specific, but that the latest findings showed, they said, that there's absolutely no problem with the oxygen level on testing. So can you clarify, please? We are a little confused. Is there an oxygen problem? Isn't there? What do we have to worry about?
We did not see any oxygen levels that were below 2 milligrams per liter, and that's sort of the magic number below which animals and other oxygen-requiring organisms start to be physiologically stressed. So if you put a fish in water that has less oxygen than that, they will be stressed. There's not enough oxygen to support their metabolism. It would be sort of akin to us climbing up to the top of Mount Everest where the oxygen levels are really low, so you struggle to get enough oxygen. The problem, though, is that there's a large oxygen demand in the water, what's called a biological oxygen demand. And a biological oxygen demand is basically a fancy way of saying that there's a lot of yummy materials in the water that microorganisms like to eat and are very efficient at eating. And the primary component of this biological oxygen demand is methane gas. There's enough methane gas in the water at the sites that we visited for the microorganisms eating that gas to consume all the oxygen and then some. So there's not enough oxygen in the water to support the metabolism of all the gas that's in the water. So what does that mean? It means that that gas, if it is consumed biologically, which it inevitably will be is going to travel into water that has oxygen in it and be consumed there. So there may not be an oxygen problem right now in terms of the oxygen concentrations are above 2 milligrams per liter, but there is certainly a potential for a very large and substantial oxygen problem because of this biological oxygen demand in the water, and that demand, as I said, is driven largely by methane gas.
We think of the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf Stream as mobile, you know, highly fluid processes of water streaming and always moving. But it sounds like you're talking about microbes that go where they want to go and stay there, and that that's part of the health of these regions, especially when it comes to coastal regions, right?
Sure. And it is all connected. There's exchange between the surface and the bottom and bottom and the top, but the scales you're talking about, the currents move at a fixed rate. You know, the deep currents can be, you know, 10 centimeters per second. And that's pretty fast moving water. So that water is moving with it, anything that's suspended in it, the microorganisms, the methane, et cetera. But it's all connected, and you get a storm pushing through there, and you push this, you know, water that contains high methane concentrations onto the slope and shelf, potentially. To replenish deep water oxygen is a very slow process because that water gets replenished primarily by diffusion. Storms don't mix the system to 1,000 meters. Storms mix the system to 100, 150 meters, certainly not 1,000. So the processes that regulate exchange of oxygen and replenishment of oxygen at those deep water depths are physical diffusive processes, and they're very, very, very slow.
During one of the recent conference calls, there was discussion about the possibility that BP would install an automatic dispenser for Corexit, the dispersant manufactured by Nalco. Do you think the use of this is a good idea, or would you like to weigh in on that?
I think that's being done already, and I don't think it's a good idea because dispersed oil is something that cannot be cleaned up, it cannot be remediated, it cannot be removed. Organisms, assuming that the dispersant and the dispersed oil is something that can be broken down by microorganisms, and that's the hypothesis, that's why you use the dispersant, presumably, is to break the oil down into little bits that are easier to digest for the microorganisms. That's a big assumption because they haven't been tested against Gulf of Mexico communities. We don't know how the microbial community in the Gulf of Mexico, per se, is going to respond to these dispersants. What if the organisms that are metabolizing this oil tend to be really hypersensitive to Corexit or some byproduct of Corexit breakdown? We simply don't know that. So to me, doing something like adding a dispersant with the single goal of keeping the oil off the surface, keeping it suspended in the water or having it sediment out to the benthos, is making the assumption that doing that is not going to alter the system or harm the system in any way. In other words, having the oil on the beach is more of a danger than having the oil suspended in the ocean water or sedimented onto the seafloor. And I don't think we know whether that's true. I don't think we can, I mean, obviously having oil in either place is bad, but assuming that there's no impact of dispersed oil in the ocean or on the seafloor is, I think, a very, very big mistake because there certainly will be implications and alterations and perturbations related with just the sheer magnitude of dispersed oil that's in the water right now.
So just to understand, you can't clean up the methane or the gas?
The gas goes into solution and it stays in the water. You can't skim it off or burn it off or clean it up off a beach. The only fate of gas is microbial metabolism or egress to the atmosphere. And this stuff is trapped 1,000 meters below the seafloor, so it's not getting to the atmosphere. It's staying in the water where it's going to be ultimately oxidized. And when it's oxidized, it's going to consume oxygen.
And so we did speak with Dr. Ed Overton, and he also expressed concern that there were no skimmers to be seen when he was out on the water. What about that? I mean, they didn't really send a lot of skimmers. Recently, we heard again from Admiral Thad Allen, the former Coast Guard head, that they were sending more, but it came 80 days after the spill.
Yeah, I mean, I know when I was out there, we saw a lot of skimmers, but we also saw a lot of skimmers floating around and not skimming. Does that make sense? They were out there, but they didn't have booms behind them. Some of the ships did, some of the ships didn't. To skim and collect the surface oil, you've got to have thick, tarry stuff. You can't really, it's not so effective to skim a really dispersed rainbow sheen. You know, you just can't do that so well. I think that, you know, one of the things we haven't mentioned is these large-scale high throughput centrifuges that are being used, Kevin Costner's invention. And those are out there, and they've got, I don't know, at least six, I believe. And you can use those instruments to separate oil from water. And they can process very large volumes. Around, I think, one centrifuge can process about 300,000 gallons a day of water and separate it from the oil to, you know, 99-plus percent purity of either phase. But again, the sheer scale of what we're talking about is hard for a lot of people to imagine. And here's the reason why. When you start a plume, when you have a well that's ejecting material at 5,000 feet water depth, as that material, some of it's going into solution below the sea surface, but even the stuff that rises to the surface, by the time it gets to the surface, it's no longer this little, very well-constrained jet. It's a large-scale feature, and it's massive. And, you know, to really boom it and collect it and skim it, you would probably need hundreds of ships. There just aren't enough vessels to do it. The scale of this blowout is the problem. It just dwarfs the capability of the cleanup crews to deal with it. It's just a massive, massive, massive volume. And it's so dilute when it gets to the surface in many cases that it's just difficult to remove it with a skimmer or to burn it off.
Well, finally, I know you have to go, but we did want to ask you about your other testing missions and things that you might be doing to continue to look at the oxygen levels, and also to respond, finally, to the question of deep-sea drilling right now in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, for economic reasons, we see some of the mayors and, you know, others in states really pushing hard to keep the jobs for these workers. But the safety factors have never been there, really, according to those who are very familiar with what BP proposed originally to MMS.
To answer your first question, we're continuing to get samples in weekly from other cruises that are going out to the area, and we're making measurements of gas concentrations and microbial metabolism on all of those samples. We have another cruise scheduled in August. And another one in November, so we'll be back out there quite frequently this fall. With respect to deep water drilling, I am of the opinion that the benefit does not exceed the cost and the potential cost environmentally. And we would be much better off actually paying what gasoline costs instead of having it subsidized and having cheap gas in this country. We'd be much better off increasing the fuel efficiency standards of automobiles and trucks. We'd be much better off if cars and trucks were not a convenience, if they were a luxury, if we're spoiled. Every family member has a car when they get the opportunity to get a driver's license. In other countries in the world, like Norway, for example, a nice car is $40,000, and a family has one of them because that's all they really need. And we need to change our mindset and cure ourselves of this addiction to oil. And to do that, I think, is going to mean changing the way that we approach what we do and how we live our lives and taking personal responsibility for this disaster. I mean, it's not just BP's fault. It's my fault. It's your fault. It's everybody's fault, because all of us drive cars. All of us consume a ridiculous amount of electricity, and we need to change that. We need to become more aware and personally responsible, and we need to make wise choices for the planet as a whole. Not what's good for me today, but what's good for everybody tomorrow.
Dr. Samantha Joy is a specialist in biogeochemistry, microbial ecology, and the metabolism and physiology of the ocean at the University of Georgia, Department of Marine Science. We spoke with her July 9th. A documentary featuring the school's work will air this week on Georgia Public Broadcasting Network. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Connecticut and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed.